Good afternoon. My name is James Hellman from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, and I'd like to welcome our listeners today to today's Object of History Forum. The Object of History is a joint project between the Center for History and New Media and the Smithsonian National Museum of American History to provide students and teachers around the country with a look at key objects from their collection. Our focus today is the voting machine that the Smithsonian contains in their collection. We'll be talking about that machine with our two guests. We have Larry Bird, a curator from the Division of Politics and Reform at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History, and Michael O'Malley, an associate professor in the Department of History and Art History at George Mason University. Welcome, guys.
Thanks. Thank you.
We have a ton of questions to get into today. Let me just start with sort of the most obvious question. Someone named Bob from Montana suggested that we start from the very, very beginning and address this issue of how people voted before machines were invented, before they introduced machines into the process. How did people cast a vote in an election?
First of all, you have to realize that the voting methods are as varied as the states that are in charge of them, and there really isn't any one, you know, timeline or thread that you can follow through and say this happened, this, then that, and then that kind of thing. But among the early ways that people voted, they could vote by voice vote, which was done in public, for example, on the steps of a courthouse, and the supervisor of elections would read a list of names, and then you would reply to your name being called and then simply state the candidates that you were for. And other ways or variations on this involved your signing a poll book, again, something that you would do in public and was open to inspection or at least the knowledge of anyone within sight or earshot of it. So those are a couple of ways before machines. And this gradually gave way to more private yet sort of observable ways in which people wrote out a paper ballot and submitted it. Later they would submit into a jar or a folder or hand it off to a person a pre-printed paper ballot. And then eventually it came down to, you know, going into a booth and marking a pre-printed ballot. But these are all, I mean, and there are various ways in which this played out, and I guess we can get into some of the complexities of paper ballots and machine ballots and that kind of thing later.
Maybe worth pointing out that the experience of voting was really different. It was a different period. It was sort of like a kind of a, not exactly a party, but like a public festival. It was very much a civic event with people on the streets and people out for voting day. It was sometimes a holiday or something that workers later in the 19th century would demand as a right, having a right to time off. It had a different, well, it still has connotations of a kind of civic festival, but it had much more of that at different periods. Would you agree with that, Larry?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, even today, for example, some labor unions make that, you know, part of their contracts when they negotiate. They make half a day off or something like that as part of the contract for voting day, and there's the expectation that that's going to be exercised.
There's manufacturers, 19th century manufacturers. If you look early manufacturers, if you look in their diaries, you sometimes see complaints about workers wanting to take election day off and insisting that it's a right. A free citizen exercising his right to vote has a right to take the day off. It's not something most people would agree with now, although still things are closed on election day.
Yes.
Like in Pennsylvania, bars are closed on election day. That's not true in Virginia, I don't think, but it is in Pennsylvania.
I don't think it is.
It used to be. I'm pretty sure it used to be. Maybe I'm wrong. Edit that out.
Maybe we can start with Larry again on this question. Alan from Maryland is wondering what the Constitution says about voting. what sort of requirements or restrictions or what kind of rules does the Constitution lay out?
Well, again, this is another basic question issue and almost a non sequitur, in that the Constitution leaves to the states how they will choose to elect or select presidential electors. And it's even quite vague about this. I mean, that there is no right to vote expressed in the Constitution until you get to, you know, the amendments to the Constitution. So initially, the Constitution is mute. It says that only that elections will be held. It doesn't really say how elections are to be held. And that's why we have this kind of variegated patchwork, you know, multitude of methods that are purely state and local.
And I think
in the way that they're laid out. So, Mike?
No, it's actually striking. It's a striking omission from the Constitution. You would think that most people, I think, assume they have a right to vote. But it's not, if they have one, it's derived from their state citizenship. The federal Constitution is remarkably silent on it, as Larry said.
Right.
And it's really, I think a lot of people would argue it comes from the idea that voting was originally imagined as a privilege, not a right.
Right.
You got to vote if you were, you know, a man of wealth or
mm-hmm.
a person of substance, that it was a privilege, not some kind of automatic right. And we still have sort of a mixed legacy about voting. As Larry said, if you chart the amendments, you can see the federal government getting more involved in voting as a right. Although it's never expressed as a right. It's expressed as something, well, sort of a right. But it has the legacy of having been a privilege, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense, actually. But, you know, at least initially it's tied to property or you know, other requirements.
Property or birth, but not so much birth, but probably property in the United States, mostly.
Mm-hmm. So then what happens, someone named Jonah from Washington, D.C. is curious about this question. So what happens then to change that? Well, as you said, you could sort of chart this progression by looking at the amendments, but is there an event or series of events that begins to change that expectation or that notion?
Yeah, well, I mean, Larry probably knows more about this than me, but that would stop me from talking first. well, go ahead, Larry, you go ahead.
You're hanging out there.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, depending on who you look at, I mean, historians look at this kind of thing. And one of the theories that is sort of interesting is that the suffrage, not only does it expand, but it can contract as well, you know, over time. So the idea that we're on this, you know, this constant track, the ball is rolling toward universal suffrage, which is sort of an often expressed ideal, in the 19th century and certainly by the 20th. It really just it can go in and out, and we can talk about that, I guess, in some detail later. But another idea that people float out there is that the suffrage seems to expand after periods of war. In other words, after the Revolutionary War, you know, you sort of dispatched with the colonial system and all of the ideas about, you know, property and suffrage that were received from Britain, and with the growth of the population, the states convene their state conventions and expand on the idea of who can vote. And then after the Civil War, you have a similar kind of expansion, you know, with amendments to the Constitution, the 14th Amendment. And then after the first World War, you have that passage of the 19th Amendment, which is allowing women the right to vote. So, I mean, those are, I mean, some of the hooks that you can hang on it, but, I mean, that's just an outline. I hope I haven't oversimplified it too much.
The standard progression people see is that by the end of the 1820s, most property restrictions are gone for white men. You have what's called universal white male suffrage, which means pretty much, it varies from state to state what adult means, but men can vote regardless of property. and there begin, you know, there are calls then for votes for women, although they're mostly ignored. At the same time, though, as they're expanding the franchise for white men, a lot of the northern states eliminate the franchise for free black people. So while you see an expansion on one end, you see a contraction on the other. Mm-hmm. And after the Civil War, there's this extraordinary enfranchisement of black men, but that's undone. By the 1890s, that's been largely eliminated through other measures. So officially, the 15th Amendment says you can't infringe on the right to vote based on race, color, or previous condition of servitude, but in fact, black voting almost entirely stops in the South. And that lasts into the 1950s.
By using other sort of legislation.
By using other means, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Literacy tests, that kind of thing.
Yeah, of course. Well, why do we need a voting machine then? What are there issues or are there specific things that come up that make that sort of thing necessary?
Well, I think, you know, you could make a general, you know, blanket assertion that some Americans, I mean, let's face it, we're machine-minded. we like
machine gadgets.
We like stuff, you know. Yeah. And the man who's generally given credit for, I mean, there are many mechanical improvements to ballot boxes, and I mean, maybe we should just back up and explain what a ballot box is. It's simply a box, or it could be a glass jar with a slot on the top, mm-hmm. into which a voter would put a paper ballot or what's called a ticket. And these were printed by the people who were running for office, or at least the parties promoting candidates who were running for office. And when you went to a polling place, you were given a piece of paper that had the complete ticket on it. You couldn't, or sometimes you could try to, mark, you couldn't change it. You had to just simply take the choice of the party you were given from any party and then put that in a box that was then counted. And there were laws and regulations that discussed the size of the paper, the color of the paper, you know, this kind of thing. But it still sort of borders on not a private act, but a public act, where you're seen putting a particular size and style type colored ballot into a box. And this led to all kinds of problems. People would insert more than one ballot. They would fold them together, and then so you're voting once, but you're counting however many ballots you were stuffing into that box, quite literally. Mm-hmm. People were making boxes with false bottoms and sides that had extra ballots, you know, for their candidate in there. And so people began to look at this and say, So then you would get boxes that had kind of like a deposit slot in it, you know, like today's ATMs, where you put the ballot into the little chute and then you lifted a lever, and then the lever tripped kind of an odometer, like, you know, readout, you know, so you could say, okay, one ballot. In other words, if you would put multiple copies folded together, you know, you would be found out at the end because you were only supposed to have, you know, raise that lever to open the slot.
Right,
so many times. So that's, I mean, these machines are rather obscure now. I'm sorry, what?
I mean, you often see in Thomas Nast cartoons, you see the ballot box looking like a goldfish ball, looking sort of like a glass ball. And that's I assume that was all about trying to get some transparency so you could see if somebody put
the globes are sort of visible from four sides, and the top has got a wooden slot, but these things are in sort of wooden, you know, cages, and it requires, you know, a minimum of three keys and three little locks to get the contents out to count it. And you see these pictured quite prominently in the mid-19th century in Harper's and Leslie's and the Illustrated News Weeklies, and you see people walking in. But again, whatever problem you've solved, you've sort of created another, because by making it public, you you allow the whole process to be open for inspection, which is good, because for people to vote and to believe in the result, they have to believe in the process that's all for real and above board. But at the same time, it's, you know, by making it so transparent like that, you're subjecting people to pressure and, you know, the possibility of intimidation by not, you know, making it a private or a personal decision.
Well, I think this is
so there's trade-offs with every one of these things. But just to get back to them, so people begin to think about machines and how they could make this, you know, more accountable, and at the same time introduce an element of privacy, privacy to it. So that's one of the things, that, just to throw that in there.
I mean, if you just think about it, you walk up to cast your vote and people are going to see it, especially, and you can find it, but what if it comes open? People are going to know who you vote for, so you're subject to pressure from your employer or your neighbors,
right.
Local neighborhood thugs in some cases. You know, you want some privacy. So as I understand, the machine is partly about trying to provide some privacy.
Right, and the machines that were developed sort of took all of the various ideas that were floating around in the world of the paper ballot at the time, and the biggest idea was taking the process of this business of having every party or candidate make their own little paper ballots to be distributed. They took that away from and gave it to, made that a government function. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could argue that the people in the government are, in fact, operating in parties.
Right.
But nevertheless, this was a big improvement because they took all the little pieces of paper and they put them on one giant piece of paper and they called it an Australian ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And so you went to a polling place, you picked up a complete ballot that had everyone's name on it. And it was organized in columns by party, you know, just like the old little paper slip things that each individual party had distributed. So then, you know, you kind of took control of that from the parties and gave it to a centrally, you know, designated government entity to do. And then they let people mark and choose and pick among the various choices that were presented, like an a la carte electoral menu. And they put it on a little shelf in a ledge behind a curtain. And then you folded it and deposited it, and that was your vote, and nobody knew for whom you had voted. They didn't see you marking it. They only saw that you took one, you went in a booth, you came out, and you put it in a box. And that was basically the setup that was in play as the kind of general approved method, you know, the most progressive, if we can use that word at this time, idea about in the late 1870s, early 1880s, when people began to think of machines, they replicated in steel the Australian ballot, you know, that huge every candidate, every office ballot. And that's sort of how they came up with the gear and lever machine. And that's still pretty much the format that is in play today in the electronic systems that we have.
It's a big deal trying to get the Australian ballot established, and there's a lot of resistance to it. I think mostly from people who are benefiting from not having it. It's
right.
Party people are pushing really hard against the Australian ballot, and they're arguing it's going to disenfranchise their voters because they're helping people figure out who's in their best interest. That's what the party's supposed to be doing, helping the voter. And the Australian ballot just confuses the voter. It's got too many choices, and it was all about reducing voter participation. That was the argument against it.
Yeah, well, there also
with
every one of these so-called improvements, there are pitfalls and potential setbacks, and there are always, always, always little nuances that play out in ways that you might not even think about, you know, today. For example, when you went in and you're looking at your nice big, they also call it a blanket ballot, let's call it that. At the head of each column, you would have written Republican Party, Socialist Party, Democratic Party, you know, Prohibition Party, you know, and on and on and on. You have to read. You have to be literate to navigate and negotiate through this ballot. Other times, they would put party symbols at the head of each column. So you would just have to know your party symbol, and then you could put your X in a checkoff box and you voted for the whole ticket. You know, so the issue of whether the ballot would be simply just printing, or does it have symbols,
right.
That, you know, that's an issue.
And I think the other thing that's the other context here is that this is partly about immigration, that the voting in the 19th
right.
century is characterized by the development of these urban political operations. You know, they're usually called machines, although they aren't mechanical, political machines where you can muster large numbers of voters to vote loyally with one party, and usually it's in return for a job or a favor or something like that. And so there's a lot of, if you're a sort of middle-class Native American, you're very concerned about these political machines, and you think they're a bad idea. Of course, if you're one of the immigrant voters, you might be pretty happy with it and think it's serving your interests. So the Australian ballot is, on the one hand, could be seen as a way to get rid of voter coercion. On the other hand, it could be seen as a way to break the power of these sort of immigrant voting blocks that have become very influential, particularly in the cities.
Okay. Very good.
Yes.
Well, we have a question from someone named Melissa, who's concerned about electoral disputes, and I guess it sort of leads to a question about how commonly there were disputes about elections before. Well, I guess this is a two-part question. How common were disputes over the results of an election before voting machines were introduced? And then, second, do machines do anything to alleviate those problems? And
Michael?
Well, you know, the most famous one is the Hayes-Tilden election
sure.
of 1876, where you can't really tell. It's clear that Tilden won the popular vote, and Hayes won maybe you couldn't tell who won the electoral vote. There was simply no way to tell, and there's evidence of massive voter fraud there. Voter fraud is a tough one because the people who committed are really good at concealing their evidence. So, you know, is there evidence of voter fraud? What was the question again? So many questions again.
Well, let's start with.
Oh, yeah, there are plenty of
common disputes. How common? You know, when we're talking about either verbal voting or paper ballots before machines, how common is it for
there's a famous painting. There's a famous painting of Jacksonian era voting by George Caleb Bingham, which shows the vote as this kind of public festival, and some of the guys are drunk, like they're being carried by their friends up to vote. They're semi-conscious, and there's a guy handing out. He's dipping, you know, from a big bowl of punch to influence voters. Is that fraud? Well, it's certainly not exactly the model of voting that we'd like to believe in. And there's certainly coercion. There are instances in the 1890s of employers telling their employees, if you vote for William Jennings Bryan, you'll lose your job tomorrow. And that kind of thing isn't exactly fraud, but it's certainly coercion. And you'd want to get rid of that kind of coercion, absolutely. And the urban political machines, particularly Tammany Hall, are constantly being accused of ballot box stuffing and voter fraud, and I think with reason. I mean, there is a lot of voter fraud going on. Larry, is that sound reasonable?
Yeah, no, I mean, voter fraud is voter fraud, and it occurs whether there are machines
or not.
Or not.
Yeah.
But the intent seems to be, or appears to be, from what you can read in the late 19th century, that by making things more mechanical, you're subjecting them to more control and the better chance of observing, you know, what's going on and being able to account for it in, you know, in a more business-like way.
Right.
But does it ever lock it out? No, hardly. Not hardly. I mean, it's just... maybe your students may appreciate the whack-a-mole metaphor, you know.
Yeah.
If something here, then over here you weren't paying attention while you were fixing what's over here, something else has leaked out the back, and, you know, I mean, every system has its pros and cons.
Right.
It's hardly a closed loop, I mean, well, we could talk for days about this.
I mean, certainly there are cases. If you read 19th century magazines, political magazines, or magazines, even popular magazines, you would think that every election was nothing but fraud. I mean, it's a constant charge of fraud. Thomas Nast's cartoons are constantly denouncing fraud, particularly from Tammany Hall. Is that true? Well, there's some hyperbole there, but there's also a base in truth. So I would say there is. That's the best answer I can give.
Okay.
There's a lot of hyperbole about fraud, but there is, in fact, actual fraud, too.
Sure.
Would you agree with that, Larry?
Yeah, I would. But the idea is security, you know. That's the mantra.
That's what the machine is about.
Yeah, for example, the guy who's most often given credit for developing what we think of as the gear and lever voting machine in New York in the late 1870s, early 1880s, was a man named Jacob Myers, and his occupation was he made the tumblers for safes. I mean, bank vaults, you know, that kind of stuff. That was his business, and he told himself that, you know, well, if I can make, you know, a man's money safe, I can certainly make his vote safe. And so that was his idea, you know, behind, you know, but again, the models that were used were, you know, to go into a booth, take an Australian ballot, and mark it. So he made a little booth, he went into it, and you're facing not a set of crayons and a piece of paper, but a set of levers that are interlocking. And eventually, the way it worked was you went in and you closed yourself behind a curtain. Closing the curtain freed up the levers on the machine. Mm-hmm. In other words, it unlocked them. And when you were satisfied that you had put the levers where you wanted them, indicating your choices for candidates and various referenda issues, then you opened the curtain and it moved little trips in the back on little odometer-like readouts, advancing, you know, in the appropriate total for the candidate. And, you know, the one drawback with this particular machine, although it's not particular kind of a fraud, would be that they had to always check up on results that ended in 99, because the trip would sometimes get stuck.
Yeah,
and so it wasn't rolling over.
But it took more than a year.
Right, so they had to always check that. But the advantages were quite literally enormous, because you couldn't walk off with the machines. You know, they weighed a couple thousand pounds a piece, so that you couldn't steal the ballots. But there were no ballots. You were just left with these little, you know, odometer-like dials that you read and tabulated at the end. And of course, you know, because there are people involved, you know, you had to accurately report the totals and not change them and, you know, all kinds of other things. But those problems had always been there with the recording of paper ballots anyway. So it was a pretty, you know, interesting improvement in electioneering.
Mike, did you want to add anything?
No, I mean, I think the other thing that, I mean, I guess the other problem with mechanical machines is their cost and complexity. They are fairly expensive,
right,
and they're complex to maintain. And so they're probably better overall. They put a burden on the local municipalities that have to buy them or rent them and maintain them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's still their drawback today, and why this pushes to replace them with computerized ballots or paper ballots.
Right, yeah. Well,
as Larry said at the beginning, they look like, they appeal to, especially in the early 20th century, where engineering and science is supposed to cure all ills. They just look scientific. They look great. You go in, there's all these levers and little things to push. I think that you can't really ignore that. They look like the future. They look modern. They look up to date. And there's just almost a real cult of engineering at the turn of the century, that engineering and technology is going to take, it's going to make everything objective, and it's going to get rid of favoritism, and it really fits in with that model.
Yeah. And I should, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm a resident of Maryland, and we in Maryland used those gear and lever voting machines up until recently, and then they've been replaced, of course, with touch screens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But when you went into that machine, and I mean you went into it, you pulled the curtain around you,
yeah,
there's a rather large lever. The thing made a sound, and it was a substantial kind of like closing the safe door. And there was no doubt that you heard those trip wheels turning, those gears clicking and clacking, and when you opened that thing, you felt as if you had done something because it gave you a mechanical, there was a mechanical sound to it, there was just a feeling about it that you don't get with a computer.
Right, it was like the steam engine. It was like running a steam engine. You had a total lever and something's going to happen. Yeah. I love those things. They were great.
Right. Well, and, that way.
But now, you know, if you go in and you, it's like the keyboard or your mouse or something. If you don't hit it down clearly or correctly, you know, what happened?
What happened? Right.
You know, I hit it halfway. What happened? You know. Did I, what just happened? Did I vote? What did I do?
Do it again.
Can I go back? Where am I? You know.
Right.
So anyway, so there are some advantages to, you know, something with a mechanical thingness about it that, oh, anyway. That's not
right.
What I, okay.
And I think they're harder to cheat. They are harder to cheat.
The next issue I want to just take a look at, we have, of course, the ability to look back and sort of figure this out backwards. But if you wanted to cheat using a machine, how do you go about doing that? In what ways are they vulnerable to fraud?
Well, today you get a hold of the software. But I think you're talking about an earlier day of
mechanical.
No, it was very difficult. To cheat. I mean, one way would be to get control of how the results were tabulated at the end, where they open up the back of the machine, they pull the light bulb around to the back, and you then recording, you're just reading numbers off of the dials.
So you could cheat there.
And you could cheat there, but usually this process, I mean, the way I understand it, was done by multiple people, so... You know, the possibility that one person is going to do this and pull this off, that isn't going to happen. It's usually attended by, you know, the constable, the policeman, and, you know, the registrar. I mean, and they're all looking at the same information and they're signing off on it and sending it off. So, I mean, it's a little, you know, the results are not disputed, typically.
Right.
But could they be? Of course. There are people involved.
Yeah, of course you could find a way to get multiple people, you know, get a single guy to vote multiple times under a different identity. The mechanical machine isn't going to prevent that kind of...
That's a different kind of fraud. Yeah.
Right.
You know, you could have a guy vote as a dead guy, that famous thing where...
Right.
So it doesn't stop that level of fraud, but at least it gives you a really solid check on the totals.
Yeah, and usually what happens...
through fraud.
And usually what happened, I mean, Mike was talking a minute ago about the enormous expense of a gear and lever machine, which is quite true. And the way the companies that made these were very clever in the way that they marketed them. They would say, okay, Mr. Supervisor of Elections in such and such state, you can combine your election districts, and instead of having, you know, five election districts, you can have one. Because the single machine will take up the work of these, you know, five areas, so that means there are four areas that you don't even have to tally up and be responsible for anymore. In other words, they centralize the whole thing. And in most of the trade literature that you see about these machines, they only picture one machine, you know, in a school building or something, or whatever it is. And you see a short little line of people who are, you know, anxiously eyeing it and waiting to get in there and cast their vote for democracy.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is pretty far from how we experience that kind of thing today, where they have multiple everything. But there's something to think about. So there were certain economies that were, you know, brought on by the advent of these rather large and, unwieldy to move around and store machines, but it allowed for other economies too, which people seem to just want to just pick up on.
Okay. All right. Well, do we know of a specific case of it? Does the record the historical record bring us any specific cases that we know of where machines were either used for a fraudulent election or it didn't prevent one in any case? Do you happen to know of one?
Boy, I don't have a good example.
I actually looked into this question. I did some research, and I couldn't find an example of machines being involved in fraud. It's a good question. I mean, it's not the machine. It's hard to...
Things that are alleged, I mean, there's certain allegations, but
right.
I guess the key word is prove, or
right.
maybe the better word would be suspected, malfeasance. But
right.
This kind of ties into the guy who invented the Votomatic vote recorder that used like an IBM, Hollerith type punch card. That already existed, and his contribution was adapting that so it could be navigated by a voter. But he had worked for voting machine companies in Chicago when he was a young man, and he just saw it all in Chicago. He doesn't really describe what that was, but just the kinds of things that went on, and this is in an environment that's totally dominated by the voting machine. Again, it goes back to how you're tabulating the results and who's collecting the information and passing it on and so forth and so on.
Right. Okay, well, Mike, you mentioned a few minutes ago this idea that the machine looks, it looks like it's going to solve certain problems. It gives people a sort of confidence about the future, about science or technology.
Right.
Well, how well does that notion fit in, or the notion of voting machines, how well does that fit into sort of the progressive ideal? Is this progress for a lot of people?
I was doing some research and I found some early turn of the century articles from political scientists and writing in professional journals, and they're generally extolling the mechanical voting machine. Like, this is what all the stance is, this is what all intelligent, educated people want. People who are against this are, corrupt, unprogressive thinking. I mean, it's clearly associated with progressive era reform. And, my favorite analog is probably scientific management, where scientifically managing the work process is supposed to solve all the disputes between labor and capital. And, if you read the historical literature is heavily in favor of voting machines, I would say. Because the people who have access to print, the people who control print media, tend to be somewhat suspicious of urban to immigrant-driven political machines. So the historical record looks heavily in favor of voting machines, and it links voting to progressive reform. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I mean, it's really clear in the record. You have to go pretty far to find a reasoned objection to voting machines. Why do you find cost, other than cost?
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that's basically right. I mean, that question is sort of interesting because if you're talking about the introduction of machines in the first voting machines at the end of the 19th century, they kind of just roll over everyone. I mean, it becomes not universally adopted, but adopted where people have money and they have interest in doing so. And in fact, just the state where these things were sort of developed first in New York State is still using them today. I mean, in the face of all of the punch card, business what's sort of interesting is where they're, when punch cards were introduced in other places, those punch card systems, which were a huge threat to the gear and lever voting machine, I mean, as a business or an industry, people who raised objections to punch card voting, when you drill down deeply and see what's going on, it's, they're the proprietors of, some interest in,
right.
in the system that's going to go.
Right. Right.
You're replacing a 2,000-pound gear and lever machine with something that has the heft and weight of a pizza box,
Right, right.
They're not about to let that happen.
Right. Go ahead, James, sorry.
Well, I was going to say that that sort of leads us to, I think, our final question for today, which is about sort of opposition. You mentioned earlier, I think, Frank, that, that there were a different kind of machines, political machines who had an interest in the old system, or, you know, where people were voting on straight tickets and,
right.
and had very little choice about that. But other than that, and I guess this includes people who have a financial interest in selling voting machines or that kind of thing, licensing patents, are there other organized groups who don't like the idea of voting machines that you know of?
Other than political machines? Other
yeah.
political machines? You know, I think there are opposition from people who, you know, what I would love to test is there opposition in the South? I wonder if there would be opposition. But no, probably not, because their big problem is stopping black people from voting, and they've accomplished that.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know of opposition from other than sort of the representatives of political machines. I might know more.
Again, I think you'd have to look at, you know, there really isn't any, except on the basis of cost, which could be an object.
Which could be real, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a fiduciary objection. But no, I mean, on the face of it, this just seems to be widely accepted, and these things go into play. And there are rival machine manufacturers that come up, and objections are always, you know, but again, it goes back to what your interests are. But in terms of, is this, someone's objecting to this as an accurate or an improvement in the way we're going to run elections, it basically, the machine wins the argument almost every time. I mean, let's just float that out there. I'm certainly open to challenge, but no, there's nothing that really crops up immediately that really comes to mind about that.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I hope you'll join us next time as we continue our discussion. We'll have a new batch of callers and a new batch of questions as we continue discussing the voting machine. So thank you.
All right, thank you, Dave.
Okay, guys, I'll talk to you on Wednesday.
All right, thanks, Mike.
Same time.
All right, thanks, Mike.
Bye.
Okay, bye.
Everyone's gone?
They're gone.